Wally, if this happened and Winterset didn't exist, and Des Moines was your nearest airport, you'd probably be pretty happy to have such a nice big airport only 19 miles away. Isn't there something to be said for this pilot being relatively inexperienced and not having practiced no-flap landings in over a year? Isn't there something to be said for the long runway, the voice on the radio? Why not go there?
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for Des Moines, and it would clearly be my second choice, or my first choice if it was the closest airport for me. But really, the thing that influences my decision in this scenario between those two airports is that we've already bumped into some low clouds at around 2,600 feet. We got into those clouds, we got back out. Even though Des Moines is reporting 3,200 feet, I just suspect the way this weather is going, it's been steadily getting lower as we proceed east. So to proceed further east, I think our opportunity to bump into some of that other weather and get more ice on the airplane overrides the advantage of the much longer runway. The pilot has lots of nighttime. That's not too strange for him. He hasn't practiced a no-flap in a long time, but to me, that's not such a big deal on, you know, 172 on a 3,200-foot runway.
Richard.
Yeah, I'm with Wally on this whole scenario. Let's be careful and not overcomplicate this thing. So, you know, there was a little bit of ice, so we need to acknowledge that. But to go deeper into potentially icing conditions and overthink this thing to make it more complicated is a problem. So, yeah, I'm with Wally on choice two.
Paul.
Yeah, I agree with Wally and Richard. 3,200 feet, no flap landing on 172 is really child's play. We shouldn't really elevate the risk beyond what it actually is. Fairly low time pilot, but he should be able to handle this. And in fact, tell you the truth, I think even a landing with flaps would not be too problematical. By making a no-flap landing, you're just stacking the deck a little bit more in your favor. And I might do one other thing, only because it's night and because this is probably an unattended airport based on what I see on the traffic counts. I might call Des Moines Tower and tell them what I'm going to do here. I'm landing here, got some ice, a little concerned about it. I'll call them on the landline after I land. And that just kind of, it's a little bit of a backup plan. It's not going to have any issue with the FAA, and you got somebody watching your back in case something does happen. Easy to do. That's what I would do.
JP.
As a person with a lot of weather experience, I would say we're leaning into a situation where it's going to get worse and not improve. One thing that I probably would have looked at, being in an airplane that doesn't have any kind of ice capability whatsoever, seeing an air mat like that and entering into that kind of trip after dark, I think does stack the odds against you, because it's hard to maintain visual on the clouds and it sometimes the precipitation. So you can't really see what you're flying into other than basing the radar returns off perhaps some 10, 15 minute old ADS-B or XM data there that you're getting inside the airplane. But I think the choice is get on the ground as soon as you can. I think the no-flap landing in a 172 is pretty much a non-event. And that runway, while shorter, it's not that short. That should be, I think your odds are you're going to be in much better shape landing there than continuing even 19 miles to Des Moines, where that weather could get a lot worse and you could be in the clouds or doing some serious scud running where you could have some obstacles that you may have to avoid, towers and things like that.
So 3,000-foot runway is definitely plenty for a no-flap landing in a 172. On the other hand, though, we all have flown with pilots who fly too fast. I mean, we know the tendency on really all landings, but especially no-flap landings, is to be too fast. And Wally, you called that out in your response too. So we've got a pilot that probably is already going to air that way. Now they've got ice and they know that they're supposed to fly a little faster because of the ice. We've got winds calm here, or light and variable, could end up being a slight tailwind. What happens if you're coming down final here and you're clearly going to, this isn't going to work, right? You're going to overrun it, or you got to go around or something. What do you do then? Do you go around? Do you try it again? Do you head to Des Moines? Let me put that to Paul.
I try it again. I mean, the airplane's holding altitude, I'm sure it can climb. So come around and take a shot at the uphill runway, which what's it, 0.7 on the uphill. Yeah. So that would help a little bit. I just don't want to make this sound more risky than it actually is. I think we tend to do that in aviation publishing, where every small risk becomes inflated to be a major risk. I don't see this as that risky, other than, yes, it is night and the pilot is low time, but if he were higher time, instrument rated, or had more experience, it's pretty trivial.
I'm with Paul on that. I think you potentially make this a riskier scenario by overthinking it. It's just, you got 3,000 plus feet of runway, you're in a 172, a no-flap landing is not a big deal. And Ryan, you made a good point about speeds, and if we can go on just a bit of a tangent, too much speed in general aviation is a much bigger problem than not enough speed. Everybody's worried about not having enough speed and stalling and, you know, the issues there. But we wreck far more airplanes running them off the runway. And the more complex and higher performance airplane you get into, the more this is a bigger problem. So we should be able to maintain speed and make a no-flap landing. And even for a 175-hour pilot, that just should not be a big deal.
No, too fast is not really an issue if you go to the 9,000-foot runway of Des Moines, right? Elaine, that's where you're going. The checklist says nearest airport, you're going to Des Moines. Why is that?
Sure, it's not quite the nearest airport compared to Winterset, but I chose that option because even though I think we all agree that the no-flap landing with a little ice shouldn't be that big of a deal, I have seen too many people in this kind of aircraft take 4,000 feet to land on a 3,000-foot runway with no flaps. In other words, I'm calling the go-around because they're just not proficient at it. And it's a common issue, I see, for various reasons, besides only practicing these things every year or two with the flight instructor, that type of thing. So I think with this pilot's stress level, the chances of not making that no-flap landing work on the 3,000-foot runway, I believe, is actually higher than in a lower stress situation, and this person is by themselves, doesn't have experience with icing. And so I think the risk level in this situation actually goes up, even though it really shouldn't be that way. And that's why I'm choosing the Des Moines option. They can get flight following. They can declare an emergency if they have to. They can even get flight following to another airport. There's a couple more to the north or south with possibly higher ceilings or better weather and longer runways than at Winterset. So I think diversion in this case will just be safer for this pilot.
Sure, and it's 10 minutes. It's a pretty nearby airport, really. Wally.
You know, I think Paul made a good point about perhaps notifying Des Moines Tower just so that that they're alert, that if you don't call them in a half an hour or so, probably they're going to send some help. But other than that, I don't see how ATC can be much help to this guy. I mean, they can't help him fly it in the ice. Sure, they can give him a vector to the airport, but he can almost see the airport from where he is anyway. I think it's, it's imperative to, someone said, Richard, I think, that don't overthink this. Let's just land the airplane. And you made a good point, Ryan, about the go-around. Hopefully our pilot would have thought that through. I don't see any problem with a go-around if he is a little high and a little long on his first approach, which I think the odds are he might very well be in this scenario. I think a go-around is perfectly safe. And as long as he's thought about that the airplane has plenty of performance and he can do that, he has that option available to him, I think that's good.
Dave, nobody's ever accused you of overthinking anything. What are you doing here?
No, it's like I'm a huge fan of Captain Bucks too, and I agree with Richard in that it's like, yeah, let's make this as simple as possible. I just reach a different conclusion, because to me, making it as simple as possible means just eliminating variables. And this guy is used to landing at his home airport in this airplane, and he's got enough nighttime. Just do what you normally do. If you're concerned about the tailplane icing, maybe use half flaps, configure early, add 5 knots to your final approach speed, but just make it as normal as possible. You know, we've got one abnormal situation in this dusting of ice. Let's not make it totally abnormal by changing configurations and going different places. Just land at your home airport, you know, and make it as normal as you possibly can.
Yeah, that makes sense. But to you, as an experienced pilot who's been in some ice before, it's a dusting of ice, right? But to somebody who has never experienced this, as a VFR-only pilot, if there's any question about just how ice works in general, right? How much effect this is going to have, how likely it is to get worse. Would you recommend a pilot without your experience err on the side of essentially what the checklist says, the no flap landing?
You know, I think everybody who's made the point that a no flap landing is not a big deal in a 172 is correct. And I think a 175 hours for this pilot that's pretty significant. I don't treat this pilot as a brand new flyer. If I'm in that situation, I just want to make things as normal as I possibly can. And this pilot is from Iowa. They're going to know all about cold and ice. And I think Paul brought up the point earlier that, you know, we often tend to make situations worse. We overcompensate to known hazards. And I know this is heresy because we all know that ice can be completely fatal in airplanes. But I've been surprised at how well, you know, lots of GA airplanes, particularly something like a Cessna with a big thick wing, flies with a dusting of ice. And I just think that, you know, hey, kudos to this pilot for noticing the slight reduction in airspeed. I think a lot of us would not even have noticed that. It just shows that this pilot is pretty tuned in to his aircraft. But it's like, as few variables as possible, stick with what you know. It's not going to be that different. And just go ahead and land with the potential sort of modifications to only use partial flaps and add 5 knots to your approach speed.
I think a lot of our listeners to VFR Mastery don't have IFR experience and probably haven't really dug into what icing actually does. And the misconception might be that it's a certain amount of added weight, a certain amount of added drag. But it is more than that, right? Maybe, Wally, you can explain what is the real hazard of ice?
Well, it's a change of the airfoil. And with a high-wing airplane, of Cessna-type airplane, for sure, with those flaps, the accumulation of ice on the horizontal stabilizer can cause that tail stall. And I think we're going to add a video in the resources that from NASA that talks about that pretty extensively. And I think that's the unsuspecting hazard there. It's the airplanes carry the weight, the airplanes carry the ice pretty good, usually, unless you really get a lot of it. But if you start messing with your flight characteristics, then that kind of changes the whole game.
Also, I think you have to be careful about being complacent if you have a lot of icing experience. I happen to because I instructed a lot in the Northeast, and 172 will really carry an impressive load of ice, but you really have to stop yourself from thinking, yeah, that's okay. If it'll carry this, it'll carry a little bit more, because you could really be surprised. And a lot of pilots have in all kinds of airplanes. Personally, I got surprised in a Mooney. I would not do that again. But this is on the low threshold of that. I think this guy would be concerned because he has no experience with it and he's fairly low time. In fact, I think someone who's more experienced would look at it and say, yeah, just a little bit of ice, so what? Actually, one of the biggest problems I see is a significantly iced windshield, because if you're at night and you're trying to land on any runway, never mind a short runway, it really messes up the landing picture. And now you've got an airplane that's not quite 100% handling the way you might expect it to. So the likelihood of not flaring at all or flaring high and hard landing, damaging the airplane that way is probably higher than any other risk.
So you could be arguing there, Paul, for Des Moines and its bright lights and runway centerline lights even, right?
I'm not arguing against it, but I think I'm looking at this pilot at 175 hours as being fairly inexperienced with regard to weather and icing. This is really his first experience, and now he's going live fire. I don't think the risk is that big, and I think the no-flap landing on a 3,000-foot runway is, to me, is acceptable risk. And so is the flap landing, for that matter, as Dave said. I think the risk between the two is probably 49-51 or something, judging on the information we have.
Elaine?
Well, just to add another layer to the list of thoughts, if you pull back to the pilot's low time and time in this airplane, what if they landed at Winterset, even using normal procedures with partial or full flaps, depending on the, what kind of 172 this is? Probably wouldn't use 40 degrees flaps if that airplane was equipped with it, but maybe 20 or 30. And it worked out just fine. Would that introduce a little bit of creep in that pilot's mind? Like, oh, okay, see that now, that little bit of ice I saw in there is no big deal. I can land normally. Would that be a factor in the next time that happens? Oh, this is okay. I've landed normally. It'll be fine. Just introduce that pilot moving forward with the flying time and possibly experiencing that again. And we all know that creep can turn out to be dangerous if taken too far.
Sure. It goes right along with what the instructor's story was, that this person's instructor had picked up ice in 172s multiple times in IFR training, and it was fine. And, that's probably not the right takeaway, that it's fine to pick up ice in a 172. JP?
I think one of my bigger concerns here, it's at night, we do have a little bit of ice, but the flight, if we continue this to Des Moines, and I don't think Des Moines is a terrible option, but if we continue, we run the risk of VFR into IMC, which could be a greater risk for a 175-hour VFR-only pilot than that little bit of ice that they're dealing with. So that's also another concern there. The ceiling tends to be lowering. I know Des Moines itself is reporting VFR conditions, but there is that between where he is now and Des Moines that you could be running into some issues.
Yeah, JP, how much are you concerned here about ice, like freezing rain potential? I know there's information that we really didn't provide that would probably help you to assess that, but what would you be looking for, or how much are you thinking about freezing rain in this situation?
With the data that I have, I'm not particularly concerned about any significant freezing rain. I think there is some potential there. The radar returns, even though they may be geographically not placed exactly where that airplane is because of the time delay, I don't think we're looking at that significant of freezing rain type event. I think the icing is going to be fairly light, but I do see those clouds probably getting a little bit lower even within the next 5 to 10 minutes based on what we've been seeing in the trends.
Do you think it helps flying towards Des Moines that you get the lights of the city potentially lighting up the cloud bases a little bit? You're not as likely to just blunder into a cloud that you didn't see?
I think the more light that you can have, I think that does help you see those bases a little bit better. But also, you're right there at Winterset. Get on the ground. And like everybody else has said, 3,000 feet, no flap or partial flap should really be a non-event. This is not a 20 or 30-hour pilot. At 175 hours, there's enough comfort factor in that airplane and also at that home airport that, in my opinion, is going to be the safer option.
Richard.
Yeah, I just want to caution us about being too callous with how we're talking about ice. There's a couple things that really scare me in GA airplanes, fire and ice, because in icing, it can accumulate faster than what you can anticipate or read. So, and I'm just thinking about, like, I just recently did a podcast with a guy who said he took off with a 172 overgrossed at night, heavyweight, stall spun, and he survived. And one of the things he said was why he did it was he remembered sitting around the airport and guys saying things like, oh, these airplanes always hold more than what the book says it can. So I just, for the experienced pilots, we have to be careful about what we're communicating when we say, ice isn't that bad. Don't worry too much about it. I don't like any ice. My airplane's not suited for it. Any GA airplane that doesn't have Fiki or any kind of ice is not suited for it. And if you see any trace of it, you need to get out immediately.
Not only is it not suited for it, it's not tested for it either. I mean, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence of 172s in ice because it happens, but it's not, as far as certification goes, it's not tested for that. Dave.
Yeah, but let's not overreact either, because I'm just thinking about Colgan, and it's like the Colgan air crash was this incredibly horrific overreaction to what the pilot thought was this tailplane ice, which it was not to begin with. So it's like, first, let's do no harm. Let's not make things worse. totally concur with getting out of the ice as soon as possible. That's what this pilot did. And let's just go ahead and land at the Normal airport. And also, you know, the whole normalization of deviance argument, let's just talk about this pilot in this particular situation on this night. If we overcomplicate this situation with all sorts of, you know, what this pilot may do in the future based on some lesson that he may or may not take from this, you know, I don't find that terribly constructive. I just think let's deal with the situation right now that the pilot is confronting and limit it to that. Because once we bring in these myriad factors of future behavior, then it just gets completely unwieldy.
Paul.
Well, Dave, to me, that's the whole point of it. I mean, here a guy gets into an adverse situation. I won't say dangerous or risky. He presumably does the right thing. He survives it. Okay, what lesson does he take from that? That's the important part of it. He's already survived what happened. He made the right decision. So going forward, what conclusion does he draw from that? And people are really have a tendency to, maybe it's 50-50, to draw the wrong conclusion. And I have seen people make some really boneheaded judgments based on past experience. And whoever said, I think it was Richard, whoever said that people sitting around the airport lounge say, oh, the airplane will carry a lot more than the POA says it will. And that's an example of that. And you really hear that all the time. And you occasionally hear people say, oh, a 172 or 182 will carry a ton of ice. I don't want to say that. I think it just gives the wrong impression to people who can't make judgments. And we see enough bad judgments, I mean, toweringly bad judgments in general aviation to really have some concern about that.
But because let's give this pilot some credit, though. I mean, he's doing the right thing so far. And how do we know what lesson he's going to draw from this? He may say that, yeah, you know, flying at night in less than good VFR is something that he's going to reconsider doing. Or maybe he's going to get an instrument rating, or maybe he's going to move to a plane with known ice capability. We can't know that. So it's like, let's just deal with the one situation in the scenario in front of us at a time. And
we can't know that. All we can do is alert him to have the discussion with himself. And it may be only a discussion with himself. You know, we're seeing an uptick in accidents just in raw numbers. I haven't put a pencil on it yet, but, and it appears to be just anecdotally that a lot of those people are people who are new to aviation or coming back into aviation, have money to buy high performance or significant airplanes and get themselves into trouble in a way that we thought we had the trend line pointing down. In fact, Richard, you watch this stuff all the time. What are you saying?
In trends of accidents or in terms of who's banging up airplanes?
Just the raw numbers.
Yeah. In raw numbers, well, fiscal year 2021, we had the safest year we've ever had on record by a long shot. It was like 30% safer than any year we've ever had. It was incredible. So this year, we've seen an uptick in raw numbers, but we knew we would coming off such an incredible year. So we're still hovering around. I think we turned in a 0.74 accident rate in 2021, and this year it's probably going to be somewhere around 0.83.
You That's know, so fatal. I'm talking about overall.
Overall accidents. Yeah, I don't know, Paul. I'd have to look at that. I track fatal so closely. Oh, in terms of overall accidents, I'd have to look at it.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about is overall, not necessarily fatal.
Let me take this back to the beginning. Let's say this pilot, so they have this experience, they get out of it, everything works all right, and their takeaway from it is, hey, I just had an accidental IMC encounter. I had an accidental icing encounter. This is bad news. I don't want to do this again. Let's rewind it back to the start. What could they have done on a night like this in terms of planning, in terms of actually executing the flight to make sure that it didn't happen? Because this is the first really truly long cross-country flight they've made. And it's, you know, you could just about call it marginal VFR at night. Let me give that to you, JP. I mean, you're looking at the weather for this flight. You know, is this a no-go for a VFR-only pilot in the first place, or what should they have been looking for?
You know, I was trying to put myself back into a number of years ago when I was that kind of pilot, and I don't think it's necessarily a no-go flight. I would have chosen to do it during the daytime because you lose a lot. We have XM and we have ADS-B and we have all these tools in the cockpit, but our eyes are still one of the most fantastic weather tools that we have. And at night, you lose a lot of that. So it's really easy to get into clouds because you're not really going to see the clouds on a radar display. It is very easy to get into some precipitation that you perhaps can't see. So I probably would have taken that trip in the daytime. Also, temperatures tend to be a bit warmer in the daytime. That may have helped out somewhat. So that's what I would have done. I would have not taken that trip at night. I think even night flight in a single engine airplane itself, you do have some inherent risk with that on a clear night when you add in the fact that the weather's not the greatest and you're a VFR only pilot. I think you do increase those risks exponentially.
Two things mitigate that for night, and but I agree with that that conclusion. One is that there are a lot of airports en route, and there's no terrain. It's flat. Mm-hmm. So that reduces the risk somewhat. But if you were really concerned about the lowest risk way to do it, I agree with you, do it in the day.
Another factor here, I think, is the visibility is good. You know, to me, visibility is more important than cloud heights almost when I'm talking VFR flying. You know, I look at that all the time, and all across he had, I think it was 10 miles visibility if I'm not mistaken. So I think his decision to launch was reasonable, and he got into some weather which he couldn't see. So it really is a tough one. Like, what would you do differently? Because I really can't fault his decision-making on the front end.
So would you say this is just kind of part of the added risk of nighttime flight that you just take on by flying at night? Really, this kind of thing can happen?
Yeah, you know what I'm thinking is, you know, I'm a real believer in that adage that it's not a lesson learned until you change your behavior. Unless you change your behavior, it's just a lesson observed. So the question goes back to, what behavior would he change on the front side of this so he didn't get an inadvertent you know, clouds and inadvertent icing.
So that raises this question. Who would say that if the outcome were exactly the same, he should do it again?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because if you can't come up with something he should do differently, then you can't really say that he shouldn't do it again.
And that, right? Dave, relates to my point about paying it forward. Okay, what do you get out of this? How does it inform your judgment going forward? And as Richard says, it's not a lesson unless you change your behavior or learn to recognize when the threshold requires change behavior.
I would have hoped that his experience from this thing would have caused him to change his behavior. He's decided to fly for one reason or another in some, you know, maybe it's not technically marginal VFR, but it's nighttime and there's low clouds. And in that part of the world, in the wintertime, in December, there's going to be lots of freezing temperatures. And hopefully he would look back at this experience and say, I got in trouble because he got, you know, the typical delay. The forecast was kind of bad, so he waited a little while, wanted to have lunch with his buddies. That we've all been there, and it just, the kind of thing drags on. And the en route stop usually takes longer than you think it's going to take. And, you know, he had a choice. He could have stayed in Nebraska at his en route stop and stayed overnight and flown in the next morning when he knew the weather was going to be good. So, but another thing I think that this brings out to me is that, you know, VFR pilots, we don't tell them much about ice. And so they either develop one or two theories, both of which are wrong. One, this 172 can carry a lot of ice and you don't need to worry about it. Or two, if you get a little bit of ice on the airplane, you're going to die. And so now you panic and make bad decisions, where this fellow certainly, you know, had an opportunity to make a very safe outcome, however he chose to do it. Friend of mine went flying with his wife, who was a fairly new pilot, and had heard just, you know, ice can be terrible. And they flew through a little top of a cumulus cloud on an IFR clearance and picked up a tiny bit of ice on their 182. And she almost jumped out of the airplane, he told me, because she certainly knew they were going to die at 9,000 feet, you know, in and out of that cloud in about a minute. And, that, you know, that was her as a private pilot. That was her view of what's going to happen if you get a little ice. So both of them are wrong. You know, you shouldn't have a lot of ice on a 172, and a little bit of ice won't kill you if you handle it properly.
Maybe that's the answer that Wally came up on is, you know, the lesson there is when you're waiting on weather to clear out, he could have waited a little bit longer till it was clear at his destination instead of launching in, anticipating it would be clear by the time he got there.
Yes.
That might be a lesson to take away.
Yeah, well, there's a positive experience in either canceling or postponing when you understand that there are no penalties for that, no ramifications of that. It's so important in any kind of travel that you have to be there.
To me, there's a valuable experience in things like this that help a person learn and grow as a pilot. And I don't leap to the conclusion that this pilot, as a result of having picked up some ice and survived it, is going to, you know, be a huge risk taker and start flying in all sorts of lower ceilings and start cheating on his taxes and start robbing banks and things like that. It's just like, it's not necessarily a slippery slope. It's just one isolated event. And to me, it seems like, to the question about is this a foolish or a reckless thing to do? You know, it doesn't strike me as foolish or reckless given the excellent visibility in the forecast. And it just seems like, hey, let's learn from this. Let's take some positive lessons from it and don't read more into it than it is, because it's just a situation of where is it best to land and how is it best to do it?
You know, I think even if you could look back at this flight and say, boy, that was sketchy, but I don't know that I would do anything different, right? It's just something that happened. This pilot still should have a number of learning experience that came out of this, right? The pilot thought before this flight that, okay, icing is not a thing for VFR. Apparently that happens, right? They thought that rain should line up with the next rad and you should just be able to steer around the next rad picture. That turned out not to be the case. You know, that you can launch and plan to just stop if the clouds end up lower than you think on the way. Well, clouds can be invisible at night. You can end up in them. And then finally, if you're going to do no flap landings and they're going to be routine, you actually do have to practice it.